The Legend of Patches Gold is a great title for something. In honor of Winchester, what urban legend or ghost story deserves a new or first big screen adaptation?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the Bishopville Lizard Man of Skateboard Swamp, who is basically a classic Swamp Thing creature, but he lives in Redneck, South Carolina, and lots of colorful local characters want to talk about having seen him, and I think it could be great.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to steal from a very popular Thrillist story. But I was fascinated. It's about this time traveler named John Titor, who captured the imaginations of a lot of GeoCities dwellers and forum participants, and he came to save us from Y2K, and he did, as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and I'm going to say Detroit's Nain Rouge, which is a red dwarf that appears before disaster hits Detroit. It first appeared in 1701, apparently. But I would like to see a movie that links him to several other monster franchises. And
The Dark Universe.
Yeah, Nain Rouge is the way into the Dark Universe.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I guess I will have to go with Connecticut's Dudleytown.
That sounds very Connecticut.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing scarier than Dudleytown. Blumhouse's Dudleytown. In theaters soon. That may be more of a Screen Gems.
Are you sure that's not the name of the town in Get Out?
I am not sure, but it is often cited as a dark vortex. A rumor has it that any visitor that steals an artifact from Dudleytown will have a curse put on them and their family.
Dudleytown.
Sure.
Nice. Goosebumps 2, Dudleytown.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's hot. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 199 and it's Tuesday, January 30th. Holy shit, it's still January. And on this day in 1931, City Lights, in parentheses, Charlie Chaplin, says Dave, just to...
In case, maybe there's another City Lights.
Yeah, it was kind of an Armageddon, Deep Impact situation there. Luckily, Chaplin prevailed.
It premiered in Los Angeles, so happy birthday, City Lights. Before we start this week's show, we have figured out what our next quarter quail is going to be. The next episode is the 200th. I don't think we're going to have it next week, but in 2 weeks, we'll have our next quarter quail, and we want your help in figuring out what we're going to do. Based on some suggestion that we had gotten a couple weeks ago from other listeners about maybe foreign films that we could watch on Netflix, I think was the recommendation. We want your help in picking a movie on Netflix that for each of us to watch that we might not necessarily watch. Like for me, you would maybe pick out a horror film. I think I'm trying to think of like what is so garbage for David, but not like the fun kind
Fox
of garbage.
Catcher. No.
I'm so not ideally, fucking watching Foxcatcher.
There is that documentary about Mark.
That's
true.
I'm not fucking watching anything related to Foxcatcher.
I think the idea of this is not so much like a death race challenge that you torture each other, but something that you think we might genuinely get something out of but wouldn't pick out for ourselves. And we've chosen Netflix just because I think it's an interesting repository of not obvious classics, but some good pick out. Yeah. So we would like you to tweet at us or Facebook us with picks for each of us of what you want kind of to force us to watch. And then we will compile them and kind of three of us will pick for the fourth one, if that makes any sense. And we'll have our assignments and then we'll come back in 2 weeks and let you guys know what we think of what you've assigned us. And so hopefully we'll do a little I'm forgetting the word of what you would say for like choosing things as a group. There's a word for this.
Vote.
Group choosing is
democracy.
Group choosing.
Crowdsourcing.
What's a democracy?
Just everyone remember, it's 2018, and this November there'll be a big group choosing. Don't forget to group choose on Group Choose Day this November.
Some states make you state that you're going to group choose months in advance, so make sure not to be surprised by your group choosing date.
Oh, this is what gerrymandering has done to my brain. Help us group choose, and thank you. Hopefully this will be a fun experiment and not a nightmare. Maybe it'll be a little bit of both. That'd be fun. The other thing that we keep asking for your help in is reviews, and we have some to choose from this week. David, welcome back from Sundance. Read some reviews.
Okay. Anything you say. Let's see. where did we last leave off? I see here. Yes. Maleficent56 says, love this show. Freeform David talking is the best. I guess that's a reference to when I was on.
Did you listen to last week's episode, David?
No. I love the show in a general way, but I love the intimacy of only two hosts. And in the regular episodes, there is a distinct lack of Dave Seven. Love the variety of opinions and takes, but I'm a Dave Seven fangirl.
Aren't we all?
Dave, I'm going to let you weigh in on this. Was this review helpful? Yes, no, or report a concern?
Oh, it was definitely helpful.
Okay, fine. Miss Inga says, it is great. I listen to every episode and have for years. Katie Rich has just the right amount of enthusiasm for movies and TV and is still skeptical. Anything Joanna Robinson does, I will listen to or read. I think David Ehrlich is a prophet. Okay. That's a new one. I never go to movies.
In that, like, guy on the side of the street waving a cardboard sign kind of prophet?
Yes. 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 I never go to movies because I cannot stand crowds or people with their cell phones, but watch a bunch of TV. This podcast helps me sort out the good from the not for me. I like the idea that those are the only two kinds of content. It's very benevolent.
It kind of is.
I am in my 60s and have never watched NCIC's. Maybe NCIC. Okay. I guess I do not fit the standard age profile for TV viewing, but I would if these podcasters said I should. Well, Miss Inga, thank you very much for the review. I don't think that any one of us would be recommending an NCIS to you anytime soon, except for Patches. Sometimes he goes rogue with terrible recommendations. I don't know. And now that he's a kid, who knows what television he's going to be watching.
When you have a kid, you're very tired. NCIS seems kind of soothing.
Yeah, well, I don't know. For now, Miss Inga, stay away from the NCIS. Thank you very much for listening. You are not our only 60-something listener. We're building a growing community of Fighting the War Room. Would we say it would be septuagenarians, or is that 70?
I thought it's septuagenarians.
Of course,
70s. Yeah.
Of course, the Sundance rot in my brain. Anyway, this was helpful because I was reminded that it's sextagenarian. And then finally, the 400 Blowfish says it's great to be fine. I started listening to this podcast a few months ago because I needed something to listen to during my commute, and I have fallen in love with it. This podcast is hosted by four film writers whose work I enjoy a lot. Oh, this is a long review, so let's plow through.
Buckle
up. Katie Rich, Matt Patches, David Gonzalez, and whose rapport makes it clear that they enjoy making the podcast as much as I enjoy listening to it. While David is my favorite, hey, and the one I agree with the most, all four hosts are smart and likable, and I mostly understand why they hold their opinions about films. The show's length allows the hosts to dig deep into the topics, and the structure makes it so there's a variety in what they discuss in any given episode. I only have two complaints about the show, but they are somewhat minor. Number one, I wish they would list the tracks they separate the segments with so that the listeners could listen to them afterwards. Dave, is that on the website? Can you see that on the website?
Well, see, the thing is, the easier I make those tracks to find, the easier it is for automated things to find those tracks. Okay. So I will say this. If you tweet at me, DA7E, and ask for anything, I will provide the tracks to you and usually link you to a place that you could get it or stream it immediately.
That's very nice.
But yeah, I'm not gonna list them because then our fun might get ruined for everybody.
Number two, I wish they would release episodes 1 through 113. I listened to the podcast on Stitcher. I'm leaving this review on iTunes. It feels more useful to do so, and it is the 400 Blowfish. So forgive me if they are available on the website or some other platform, but I would like to listen to the gap between the end of Operation Kino and the available Fighting in the War Room episodes. These two complaints are pretty minor, but I would love to have more of my favorite podcasts to listen to. I'm worried that my recommendation for the Corticwell went a bit long, so I'd recommend that you don't read it on the podcast. P.S. With regards to the Corticwell, I guess we're going to do it, about watching horror movies that you might not have seen otherwise. I feel that you would probably already be familiar. Wait, how do we already have a recommendation?
So you read this in advance.
On the air.
And then you talked about it.
Okay. I don't know. Our listeners are good. I don't know what's happening. I feel that you would probably already be familiar with any film I'd recommend. So I decided to recommend a couple of TV shows instead. First, I recommend Terrace House, a Japanese reality show in which a group of young people, three men, three women, live together in a house while a group of panelists observe them. While the premise of the show is similar to that of the real world, the execution is anything but, with events happening in an understated, realistic manner. That actually sounds pretty good. The other show I'd like to recommend is an Australian sitcom called Please Like Me, also the name of the war. It follows a young gay man named Josh, played by creator Josh Thomas, throughout his misadventures in young adulthood. Similarly to my other recommendation, the premise brings other shows to mind, and PLM also shines because of the details. PLM stands out from other gay TV shows because of the low-key way it deals with the main character's sexuality. Josh worries about being an awkward person more than he does about being a gay one, and the conflicts come out of the character's personalities, not their sexualities. It stands out from other millennial hangout comedies because of the importance it gives to Josh's relationships with his parents. His goofy stepmom and dad, as well as his bipolar mom, are standout characters. And it stands out from other TV shows about somewhat unlikable people because the unlikability is never mean-spirited, and the characters are actually lovable deep down. I could go on about these two shows, but I'm already really anxious about how long this review has been, so I'll just stop. P.P.S. I'm sorry if this is horribly written, but I'm writing on my phone, so reviewing this wall of text is very difficult. Not horribly written at all. What a feat to write such a lengthy ode to this show, filled with very exciting recommendations, a very helpful review.
Thank you.
I want to check out both those shows. Can you imagine like a low-key The Real World in America? Like how quickly that would bomb?
Oh, it would. They'd have to not know they were being filmed. That's kind of the only way you would do it.
Just when you think that there's too much American television, Australia makes television. I mean, how are we supposed to keep up?
That's where all of our Australian movie stars come from. So leave us a review, please, and then give us our Quarter Quell recommendations, and then leave us a review about our Quarter Quell. The cycle continues, and thank you all very much for chiming in and reviewing the show.
Alright, so I just came back from Sundance, and I'm told that I talked about it last week in some capacity.
That when you tell David to record something for you for your podcast, he'll do it. No promises on the circumstances in which he'll send it.
It's actually not true. I may not do it, but on my podcast, I'll do it. The thing about Ambien is other listeners out there may know is you don't often remember those 30 minutes or so before you fall asleep. I have seen a lot of movies that I have no recollection of whatsoever. This is the case with this. I don't really remember what I said, what I talked about, sure to frustrate Matt Patches in the following segments. But he was off creating another human being. So who's to judge? Who's to judge?
Anyway, I was on the podcast last week.
Oh, whatever. Sundance, I came back. I think that the vibe, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, the vibe from Sea Level, the impression that people seemed to get down here was that it was a weak year. But I think that's not entirely the case. I think
it's a weak year when your metric is like big sales or, you know, big or Oscar prognostication.
Oscar buzz, yes.
12. Mm-hmm. If you want to make the call for Best Picture 12 months in advance, you hated this Sundance. But if you like
which
good
for
movies,
the last couple years has happened. Like in several years in a row, you've gotten Best Picture nominees debuting at Sundance, and this year seemed to break that pattern.
Right. I mean, it's been hard. It's been a little bit as noxious as it can be for people to walk out of a movie at any time of the year and immediately start talking about awards potential. The buzz around some Sundance movies in previous years has proven true. It has not been baseless flapping of the gums. You know, it's like Call Me By Your Name, Get Out, and things like that.
Brooklyn.
Beasts
of the Wild, etc.
Yes. I mean, now we're really going back. But yeah. This year was definitely a different flavor. I don't think that was necessarily intentional. It was just the movies that came in. I highly doubt they had anything that would stir up Oscar buzz and then rejected it. It did make for a more interesting Sundance, a more challenging Sundance in a lot of respects. The favorites were scattered. I was actually really pleasantly surprised, that IndieWire's poll of the best Sundance movie turned up my favorite Sundance movie, which I didn't realize that I had all that much company in thinking this, which was Josephine Decker's Madeline's Madeline, which I'm sure I talked about on last week's podcast. Which is a wonderful movie that will be lucky to get much distribution, let alone Academy Awards attention. Is really extraordinary filmmaking, and look forward to talking about it if it ever comes out.
Does it not have distribution at all?
No, a lot of movies at Sundance, actually, more so than usual at this point, still don't have distribution. I mean, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which I don't think I had seen by this time last week, by Desiree Akhavan, who had made Appropriate Behavior, is a very good movie, I thought, does not have distribution.
And that's got like Chloe Moretz and is like about gay conversion and it's kind of buzzy.
Yeah. I mean, like, just because it doesn't have distribution now does not mean that there isn't a lot of attention and that offers haven't been made and so on. It's just that they, it wasn't scooped up by, you know, with a $10 million deal of some kind during the festival. You know, there are movies like Burden, like Blaze, like, which is Ethan Hawke's. You know,
well, even something like Mandy, right? Mandy, the Nicolas Cage kind of 80s action throwback hasn't been picked up, right?
I would not put Mandy high on the list of the most viable acquisition titles. Now, mind you, I did not see Mandy, but to quote F. Murray Abraham, I don't see a lot of money here. I mean, Nick Cage's track record in recent films hasn't been great.
This is like a Magnolia... This is a classic Magnolia Sundance pickup. You can cut a cool trailer.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. And will it end up there? Who knows? But it was interesting that a lot of the really high-profile stuff already had distribution going into the festival. I don't think that I'd seen this time last week Hereditary, the horror movie that had everyone abuzz.
Who's the actress in that?
Toni Collette. The trailer is out now. By the time that people listen to this, the trailer is available.
Wait, is it really?
Yes.
Oh.
So that's a little something.
I have not seen the trailer, as you can tell by my voice. I would recommend that you do not watch it, regardless.
Yes, it's full of crazy. So.
This is a movie that it's January, so maybe it'll be another example of this later in the year. But by all indications, seems to be this year's The Babadook, or this year's The Witch, or this year's It Follows, in that it is smart, arty horror. But unlike those movies, this movie arrives sort of in the form of a more conventional mainstream horror movie. It really feels like The Conjuring made by someone with a lot more interest in themes and characters and emotional payoff. It's a lot more patient than the Conjuring movies. But I do think that it has huge crossover potential because audiences that really just like to stick to the schlock, that may have been bored by something like The Witch, will get what they came for. But audiences that are looking for a little more will be satisfied as well. And if there's, you know, I don't necessarily foresee this happening, but Toni Collette is so fucking good in this movie and so deeply unnerving that I don't think that an Oscar nomination is out of the question. She would have to get over a hump that that Essie Davis couldn't, and you know, that Anna Taylor-Joy.
Look at you doing awards buzz.
I know. What is this?
But you know, we're grasping at straws here in terms of Sundance Oscar stuff, and obviously a lot of docs will be in the mix. But Toni Collette is amazing in this movie. It's a haunted house thing.
But what's interesting about it is that A24 brought it to the festival, right?
Yes.
A24 produced this movie. Yes, I'm getting you on track here. A24 brought it to the fest, and it's already picked up. And same with Eighth Grade, the Bo Burnham movie that was kind of popping.
A24 has a release date for Hereditary already locked down in June, the beginning of June.
Is Eighth Grade also an A24 movie?
Yes.
It is indeed. Eighth Grade is fantastic. And I'm glad that, you know, I didn't go into it with any preconceptions. I don't know who Bo Burnham is. I knew it was made by a YouTube star, but there was already such positive reception.
Bo Burnham is not a YouTube star.
Bo Burnham was kind of like an early YouTube star, right? Like
Bo Burnham's like an early internet star turned comedian.
He's like Justin Bieber era YouTube.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
He is way too accomplished for any 27-year-old, so fuck him.
Bo Burnham was going to be in a Judd Apatow-produced High School Musical spoof. Look that old movie news up.
Wasn't he in Funny People when he was like 20?
Yeah, Judd Apatow scooped him up and was going to
David, you've seen Funny People so many times.
I've just by based on seeing his photo on the internet and now remembering back to Funny People, I can see him. Eighth Grade is really, really wonderful. So A24, two strong films of the fest. Netflix and Amazon, which we'll talk about, did not buy anything. But Netflix brought one of my favorite films to the festival, Private Life by Tamara Jenkins. Instantly forgotten about on day one. Even though Paul Giamatti and Catherine Hamm if Netflix ever bursts out of the Netflix self-created bubble, could get some awards attention.
How can you say that when Mudbound Mary J. Blige is nominated for an Oscar this year? What are you talking about?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, she did. She did get that film.
You're living in your own hot take world.
No, Rachel Morrison got a nomination. The screenplay got a nomination.
Yes, Rachel Morrison.
Yeah, you're delusional.
But this movie didn't make the impression that Mudbound did. Mudbound would have had to have cleared the way in a way that it might yet. I mean, we don't know.
Well, but this seems much more like the Meyerowitz stories. Like, it's a smaller scale movie that might have a more limited appeal, and without kind of the big, you know, coastal release strategy, it might
it's
get
about
swallowed.
Juice. I get what you're saying. It's about Jews.
I didn't know it was about Jews.
I actually can't remember if they're Jews, but like they play a Jewish couple at the very least.
Aren't they in New York? Like unhappy New Yorkers, right?
They're like unhappy, very literary New Yorkers in a rent controlled apartment on Avenue in East 6th Street. But I don't think, you know, Katie had mentioned to me off podcast that she wanted to talk about Netflix and Amazon as though, especially Netflix's lack of involvement was, I don't know, maybe a sign of weakness or they were unsure about some of the acquisitions they made last year. I think that Netflix not buying anything is actually a perverse kind of show of strength. They don't need to buy anything. They have this independent content team that is, or the Sydney content team rather, Anne Thompson of IndieWire, for plugging our sites, wrote a good piece about this, that have green light power for anything under $10 million. And they can just look at something like Private Life, which costs like $7 million or whatever it was, and green light it and fund it and so on. And then they'll bring it to Sundance and they'll do what they want with it. But they have less of an appetite to pick up these festival titles because they can fund them themselves, they can bring them to the festivals, and then just use that to, give them the boost that Netflix is still not willing to give their own movies once they're on their service. But yeah, they don't need to get into the mix. I mean, if they saw something that maybe these guys really fell head over heels in love with, maybe that would change. But right now, they seem to not need the festival copy.
Well, I'm surprised they don't need the documentaries to pick up. I mean, obviously, they have a documentary wing of their operation as well that's producing Netflix originals.
Though, I think that they are just going to take a big old net in a few weeks and just trawl everything that was at Sundance and pick up what they can. I mean, there are movies. There's a movie called Inventing Tomorrow about kid inventors. And I was like,
oh my God. Like, oh my God.
This is on Netflix already. Amazon, I think, is in more of a period of flux where they're really figuring out what their identity is. They're trying to regroup after the whole Roy
Price. They're trying to produce a $100 million Lord of the Rings television show.
Yeah, they want their Game of Thrones.
Oh, no. It's like a $240 million Lord of the Rings.
Well, they also paid how much money to Woody Allen?
The $80 million or something.
Yeah, so I think they are more in a wait-and-see mode. But
But Netflix is trying to make Bright, too.
Oh, boy.
You gotta save
up. My question about Netflix and Amazon is, like, I'm curious about how it is in the larger sense for Sundance and when it can be as a festival. And then for me, as someone who's watching it from a distance and, you know, reading some reviews and seeing some Twitter buzz, like when something doesn't get picked up, when there's not like a headline about where I'm going to be able to see this, like I feel so little investment in jumping in on these movies at all. Like it feels kind of pointless to wonder about Eighth Grade or whatever the Tamara Jenkins movie is. I already forgot about it because it's so far removed. It might not get released. Like it feels a lot more of a black box than it has been in recent years where you get to the end of it. You're like, okay, so Lionsgate picks up Big Sick. That's going to be their play. Classics has Call Me By Your Name. Like it feels like there's a strategy that's missing.
Well, I mean, you know, the movies you cited have very clear releases lined up. I mean, I would imagine Eighth Grade.
But I didn't know any of that until we started this conversation. Like, I didn't know if any of them had distribution. It just felt harder to know from a distance.
Yeah, I mean, it's just about the level of involvement you want to put into it. If you, I think that especially as the distribution landscape gets a little bit spottier and there are more roads that films can take to reach audiences, that will become less clear.
Well, we haven't even talked about The Tale, which was one of the buzziest movies out of Sundance that's going to HBO directly. It's not even going to play in theaters.
I have mixed feelings about that because, you know, I want everything to play in theaters. That's my thing. I also think that The Tale is a movie that people might be more comfortable watching at home. I think it's a movie that people need to take a chance on. I think that there are people who might be a little bit too close for them, and they might want to test the waters and have the option to bail in a way that you don't really get in a movie theater. So
What is the tale?
Did I not talk about it last week? I must have.
I think you did a little bit, but
the tale is a movie by Jennifer Fudd. The tale is a staggering piece of work. I mean, like, it's really it's going to be much discussed wherever it winds up. But Jennifer Fox, a documentary filmmaker, essentially made this movie, her first fiction is the wrong word, but first movie with actors. If you did not know her story, it would play exactly like a fiction film. There's no tell in it that it's coming from her own life. But Laura Dern plays Jennifer Fox, and this is a memoir. Everything that happened in it is true about Laura Dern. Jennifer Fox is a documentary filmmaker living in New York, is engaged to Common, and they have two sex scenes, which take on added resonance as the movie goes on. And her mom, is played by Ellen Burstyn, finds a short story that she wrote when she was 13 that essentially, in very buoyant rose-colored terms, as though it were a love story, lays out her repeated rape and sexual abuse by people, adults in her life when she was 13, by these two people, this older couple who were predators. And Jennifer Fox, at age 40-something, reads the story. And it's like, no, this was a beautiful thing for me. I loved it. I don't know. Like, this is crazy. But there's a little bit of like a pee under the mattress sort of thing. Something's uncomfortable to her. She's having difficulty reconciling what it sounds like she wrote with what her understanding as an adult woman. And so she begins to poke at her past and talk to some of the people that were at the same writing camp where this happened. There are a lot of flashbacks in the movie, and the past communicates with the present directly to the screen. Elizabeth Debicki and Jason Ritter play these people from her past. It is one of the most affecting movies I have ever seen. I mean, I likened it to The Act of Killing and just like how incredibly unsettling it becomes. I think that it's sort of a landmark film about sexual assault. I think it's too personal to conflate with any sort of movement that's happening right now, but it is surely well-timed for people to be receptive to just how this works and the nature of abuse and how it's perpetuated and how people protect themselves from it once it's already happened and the truths that we tell ourselves. I mean, it's a really staggering film. And HBO might be a great home for it. I don't know. But
it's Laura Dern factory these days, so it seems like
Laura Dern is great in this movie, it goes without saying. Elizabeth Debicki, who's someone who every time she's on screen, I'm like, oh, she's really great. I mean, I thought she was so striking in The Great Gatsby. I thought she was great in I'm blanking. She was in something else. Man from Uncle, thank you. Her performance in this movie is as scary as anything in Hereditary. And that's pretty fucking scary. You will find out later this year.
Man, Sundance is a bummer sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Dave, did you get wind of anything from Sundance that you're curious about?
Oh, no. Just I think everything that came up and then that really weird movie about a guy finding his white voice, which David talked about, I think we'll all be good. But I do agree with you that it was sort of like a black box here from the outside, in the sense that I heard like various buzzings, but like at some point I was trying to compare David's Paddington rating scale against each other and just gave up. So I'll be interested to see these movies, but you know, like Call Me By Your Name, which I just saw this month, a year after it premiered, sometimes it takes a while to trickle down. You know? So I'm excited about the HBO picking ups and the middle school, what is it called?
Eighth grade.
Already having a release date. Like, those sort of things excite me as the general movie lover, but I didn't get buzzed for them. Like you, I just learned about them now. But happy I'm going to get to see them earlier than a year from now.
I look forward to never seeing Hereditary and having you all tell me about it. P-O-P-P-Y, I'm poppy. P-O-P-P-Y, I'm poppy. P-O-P-P-Y, I'm poppy. P-O-P-P-Y, that's me. Welcome to the new world. I'm your internet girl.
Okay, for our mini segment, we're quickly going to shout out to a film that comes out probably in limited release or what is it? It's got to be.
It will
a
be somewhere
release.
This weekend.
It's opening in 5,000 theaters. It's the biggest release of the year. It's called A Fantastic Woman. It is Chile's entry for Best Foreign Language Film, and it was nominated for the Oscar. Am I correct, Katie?
Yes, it was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film Oscar.
Yes, so Una Mujer Fantástica. I wanted to talk about this a lot because I recently watched it and was really impressed by it. It's from a filmmaker named Sebastian, I'm probably going to botch this, Lelio. The film is produced by Pablo Larraine, who directed Jackie and Neruda last year, double movie. He directed No, which Katie and I both dig.
Love that movie.
And it definitely has, you can tell that this is like Pablo Larraine shepherding this movie, I think, a little bit. It's very embedded in the neighborhoods of Chile. And I was kind of blown away by this. I think at the center of this movie is a woman named Marina, who is transgender, and she is absolutely in love with this older man named Orlando. He must be 30 years older than her. It's a big deal that he's kind of an older man and she is a very young woman, and they are entangled at the beginning of this movie. And unfortunately, he all of a sudden falls seriously ill. Then he falls down a flight of stairs, and on his way to the emergency room, he dies. That's not a huge spoiler. It happens right in the beginning of the movie.
Not a great day for Orlando.
No. Orlando had a bad day. Well, he did get to like have sex and have a nice meal. So there's something to that. I mean, if you're going to go, you might as well have a wonderful evening and then fall down a flight of stairs. Anyway, this is not a good thing for Marina, who is a waitress, and obviously she's struggling as a transgender woman. Some people understand where she's coming from in this world and trying to live her life. Other people, specifically Orlando's entire family, does not see eye to eye with her life choices. And of course, this becomes a huge deal when she is trying to understand where she's going to go in this world. She's been living in Orlando's apartment, and she wants to mourn her lover. And none of these people want anything to do with her, and they want to kind of seize back their father and you know, put him to rest, cremate his body, and end their relationship with her forever. They are totally aghast that he would ever be with this woman. And yeah, it's just a character study following her. She starts getting investigated by police because it was kind of weird that Orlando fell down a flight of stairs and people are suspicious about that. But then they're also wondering if he had some sort of like sexual, you know, aggression towards her. They're testing her for, it seems like they're testing her for rape. That was a little unclear, but you know, the police think something is up. So she's getting hounded by them. She's getting hounded by the family, and she is just trying to make it into this world. And this transgender actress, Daniela Vega, who apparently was a hairdresser to begin with, and then she became a model, and now she's an actress, is just absolutely fantastica in this movie. Yay! You know, this movie is practically portraiture. We're just following her around in these different moments, and the camera is steady on her face most of the time, observing her, watching these people scream in her face, or these people try to understand where she's coming from and understand her romance. And I was just totally enraptured by her as this screen presence. The movie gets a little silly, I think, at times. There's a scene where she's driving in her car and she's listening to I'm Every Woman. That's a bit on the nose, but the movie does take some.
I asked them to do that for my montage.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, it was just perfect for the mashup.
They were happy to oblige.
But the movie does have this kind of whimsical edge, too. She's a singer in the movie, and she is constantly fantasizing her life being a little bit more perfect. If she's in the nightclub, she'll kind of suddenly fall back, and she'll be in a dance sequence, or she'll imagine. There's a scene where she's walking down the block, and the wind is blowing up against her, and then the wind all of a sudden is like practically sweeping off her feet. It's a crazy world that she's living
it's
in.
Very and Javier Dolan.
Yeah, and so it can take those turns and feel natural about it. And I was totally on board. I just thought this was a really lovely little character study. David, it was on your list. What did you make of A Fantastic Woman? Why is this nominated for an Oscar?
What you said. I haven't seen this movie since Berlin of last year, so it's been a year now. I remember liking it very, very much. And I don't think I could really do any better than you did, other than to say that very few performances last year stuck with me the way that Daniela Vegas did. And that I hope that this isn't her, her only role, that she can just get more work.
Yeah, I was going to ask, so she is continuing, it's not like she's a non-professional who was picked up for this, she's now a professional actress.
Yeah, I don't believe this is even her debut role. I think she's had some work in the past, and of course she's been a model. She was in some commercial campaigns or something, but yeah, this is her, obviously, breakout role. I guess if she could speak English, she has a future in Hollywood, perhaps, but who knows? I mean, the problem is that transgender women still have a huge uphill battle in being represented normally in film, or being represented as themselves. And this movie, while it's such an interesting dynamic. I mean, obviously we live in a progressive world, and people who listen to this show probably know transgender people, and they can go about their days, doing whatever they want and living normal lives. And in this movie, you get to see Marina, just be a waitress or walk around and talking to her sister and her husband like it's no big deal. And everyone is totally understands where she is. She's a woman. She's a fantastic woman. And then you see Orlando's family come, and just like, Orlando has a daughter who is just ripping her to shreds, who also seems kind of like down to earth, but cannot get over. She calls Marina's life a perversion. And that, when, we see some violence against Marina in the movie too, some of Orlando's son's goon friends kind of like tape her face up and beat her up a little bit when she starts coming to the funeral and that sort of thing. And that's ugly. But watching this woman just rip into her, calling her perverse, I found that to be really disturbing. Just describing the transgender life as corruption. I found that to really be sickening, but so true. I mean, this is the world we're living in. I feel like every day we're hearing fucking something terrible being put against these people, and it's upsetting. And this movie captures it perfectly. Perfect Sunday afternoon viewing.
Yeah, it looks like it's open in New York and LA this weekend, and as with many foreign films, it's really impossible to tell how far it's going to expand, but presumably it'll be available for some sort of digital download relatively soon.
Hopefully. It's a Sony Pictures Classics movie, which, as we get to, means it might be a little trickier to find before Oscar time if you don't live in a major outlet, but who knows? I mean, it's probably going to expand. It's definitely worth checking out.
It's looking like we're getting it here in February, so I would say things are looking good for large cities in America.
There you go. Thank you,
Oscar. The Oscar nomination is going to help out there.
Yeah. So, a fantastic woman.
Where do you look
woman.
To tell what's coming to you, Dave? Oh, sorry. I thought we were done.
Oh, yeah. A fantastic woman. We're done already.
So I finally saw Call Me By Your Name this weekend in a theater where I was supposed to see it legally by buying a ticket. I'm one of the few people, apparently, that has actually gone out to see this movie, which was on all of your top 10 lists, I believe. And
you suffered listening to us talk about this great Italian vacation we took for months, and now
since
you finally bought a ticket.
Last Sundance, probably.
Yeah, in David's case, for literally a year. Or Pastor, did you see
it? I saw it too.
Sorry, I can't remember everything you do.
I used to go to Sundance.
Catches and I braved quite a storm to see this movie.
Oh, yeah. We drank red wine after this movie. Anyway.
We did.
Oh, memories.
And then ate food.
So I finally got to see it. Unfortunately, because it's been a year of hearing other people talk about it, I think I was slightly overhyped for it. I think especially on the tail end of, not that Oscar nominations are a way to empirically judge all film, but in terms of categorizing things that are a certain caliber, you expect it to be up there, and it definitely was. But in terms of you guys putting it up against things like Lady Bird and Get Out and Dunkirk and you guys being not only the three of you, but the Academy in general. I think that I was maybe expecting too much from it, or was just like in a mood for something that was, I think, much more unexpected, when what I got was something that was absolutely delightful, with a couple of not groundbreaking, but amazing performances. Timothée Chalamet's might be groundbreaking, depending on how much you personally recognize a teenage boy within yourself, like I sort of did.
Do you identify with him in this more than in Lady Bird?
In Lady Bird, I identify with like his personality, but there are certain things about being in love for the first time or being confused about who you're in love with that I think were manifest in this film that I think instantly felt real to me. Mm-hmm. But then something about like the electricity of somebody else's touch, sort of based on the entire situation around your relationship to that person. It's a movie that's very meditative about the relationship between these two people, and I enjoyed that, but it was more like delightful and a little personally nostalgic. I don't know. I was talking to Java afterwards. I feel like I've seen a lot of movies about people who like go to Italy for some reason and end up discovering something about love. And
like
it's
the Amanda
definitely
Knox
like
documentary, for instance.
Yeah, like the Amanda Knox documentary. That's definitely what I was thinking of.
Wow.
Gallipoli, I think, is also about that.
Wow. Did not expect a Gallipoli reference on this episode. Yeah.
And it's definitely among the top crop of that, but I don't think it was, completely... I guess I could see you guys seeing this in Sundance and then having a lot of wine and being like, that was a fantastic portrayal of this certain type of thing. I just think it's interesting that I saw it in a context of like a Best Picture race and of a you guys
see, this is what I'm
putting it like way up there with other things. But it's like I walked out of Lady Bird like feeling better about myself.
This is what I really want to dig into. I really want to
dig
into this.
Wait, hold on. Before you dig in, I want to say something really stupid and shallow. We have to stop saying we walked out of movies. I think every time somebody says that, I imagine them like walking out of the movie.
Right. Like leaving before the movie is over?
Exactly. Not simply like exiting. We
watched the credits.
When
and
the film
exited.
Was over.
When the film was over and Lady Bird was over, I felt like uplifted and like I understood something about myself. And also when Call Me By Your Name was over, I felt uplifted and like I'd been shown something that I already understood about myself. And I think those two experiences are very slightly different.
Well, so this is what I want to dig into, that when we were talking a little bit off the podcast too, and you're alluding to this, you said that you thought it was good, but it wasn't groundbreaking. And you kind of used the word before. And I find that really interesting that there is a bar that whatever groundbreaking means to you. I think other people have shared this sentiment. Certainly my wife doesn't really care for this movie that much. And I know other people don't. And that she also cited that it might have been overhyped. And I want to kind of back it up because obviously we've been talking about this since Sundance. And then for some reason, Call Me By Your Name, maybe it had like a very small limited release in November when I felt like everyone was running 1,000 pieces about Call Me By Your Name all at once. And I don't know if our listeners feel this way, just the way the kind of like media ebb and flow, you know, when Vulture runs 100,000 pieces about the fruit scene in Call Me By Your Name, like that's when certain things reach peak conversation. But the movie wasn't even close to coming out yet. As we've seen, the movie is bombing because of this kind of strange rollout by Sony Pictures Classics, that the movie is still in limited amounts of theaters. No one's going to see it. It's made very little money. And it just hasn't had this moment. And I wonder if it's completely overhyped. We're like, the movie is finally coming out and we've reached Call Me By Your Name backlash, or, you know, Armie Hammer's too old for this movie, or this movie doesn't dig deep enough into the relationship, or they're talking about sequels at this point and it's ruining it for everyone. Like, is this movie a case study in
being totally ripped to shreds by the time Dave gets to see it finally in a theater when it's being meant to be seen. Like, this is the time. This is the release schedule. You're not past the prime, Dave.
I think that, unfortunately, I don't think the movie was really chewed up that much. There was, you know, a whiff of dumb controversy a few months ago about the age difference between the characters, but that didn't really take
hold. Hey, Katie thinks Armie Hammer's too old, right, Katie?
Yeah. I was not expected to be called to the front of the classroom.
I mean, Katie might be
called like, you out by your name.
I think there's a difference, I would imagine. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but between whatever Katie thinks and like the moral outrage that people were trying to So I know
Katie's outraged,
but like, you know, she may have some concerns, but it's not, it may not work for her in a story sense. But
it was number two on my list, guys. I don't put me in that camp.
Katie hates his boots.
Yeah, there you go. So
no Foxcatcher.
But I do think, unfortunately, I am looking right now, in fact, at Box Office Mojo's list of gay and lesbian films. And while there are a few breakout successes that we tend to associate with like the mainstream examples of the genre, you have your Brokeback Mountains at $83 million, The Birdcage at $124 million, and then there are a few movies that you wouldn't necessarily first associate with LGBT content, like Interview with the Vampire, which is number two at $105 million. But unfortunately, most of the box office grosses for even the most successful of these movies are pretty low. Call Me by Your Name at $11.3 million is already the 36th highest grossing, as far as Box Office Mojo is concerned, gay and lesbian film of all time. And I think it speaks to a really ugly either disinterest or antipathy towards gay stories, and particularly stories about gay men, that a lot of Americans, I think there are a lot of Americans who wouldn't necessarily identify as homophobes, who don't want to, on a Saturday night, go spend their money.
But how can you say that when the movie hasn't been readily available? You're still talking like it went wide when you were talking about it.
Because
I'm saying that
no gay movies do well ever.
Moonlight made like $28 million.
That's nothing. That is nothing.
On a $4 million budget?
It seemed reasonable to think that Call Me By Your Name could make Moonlight money.
Moonlight is the 19th highest grossing gay lesbian film of all time. Of all time, at $27 million.
But David, what do you think is what kept Call Me By Your Name from grossing as much as, say, Moonlight? Other than, I guess, the fact that we don't really think it will win Best Picture.
I mean, I think Moonlight did not, you know, I don't think Moonlight was buffeted by the fact that it was a gay film necessarily. I think that it was really a phenomenon in its own small way. I think it was sort of a perfect storm of things that people wanted to see. And A24 handled it really well. I don't really know what Sony Pictures Class is doing with Call Me By Your Name. But I am saying that...
Nothing. I didn't know anything. I didn't see anything about it that wasn't you guys telling me about.
And the movie
Call
has...
By Your Name.
I mean, I know this is all relative, but the movie has really not been discussed as often in recent months, anyway, as your Three Billboards and Shapes of Water and so on. But I do think that it's unfortunate that... I mean, I think this is really maybe just a reflection of my own... myopia and the fact that, you know, I live in New York City, and to me, Call Me By Your Name is like fucking Black Panther. I mean, it may as well be the biggest movie of the year. I am a little bit dismayed when I was looking at this list and just seeing that so many of these movies, the upper echelon of their success, is still under $30 million.
Call Me By Your Name has still only been in 815 theaters. That's the most this weekend.
It's not getting there.
I know it's not getting there, but what I'm positing is that the conversation that kind of elevates these movies. I mean, we talked about this in terms of Netflix too. That, like, what is the modern critic, or what does the press really do for these movies? It sniffs them out and points to them at the right moment. And in the like sea of Netflix movies, it's very easy because you can pull it up right then and there. We can all talk about it, and even if it's buried under a million garbage movies that Netflix has programmed and original series on top, you can still find that movie. The problem with Call Me By Your Name is it had this weird conversation. I feel like, yeah, Katie, you mentioned it. We've had conversations, small conversations, about this movie kind of peppered through the last 3 months of
Toronto, where I saw it, was about 5 months ago,
right? But then it's like, how do we get on the same page and talk about it when people can really see it? Only now can people really see it, and then they miss this Oscar boat without having like a big Oscar push. Suddenly a movie like this
completely flies off the rails. It's not going to make that money, even as it kind of slowly expands. The whole plan seemed off. And then,
I mean, this feels like a movie that really could have benefited from VOD early on. Just because, like, what David's talking about, I don't think that a lot of people go out and make it part of their, you know, Saturday to go to the art house and see a gay romance, or at least the box office doesn't bear that out as an actual.
But you're
plan
also
that
calling
people...
it not groundbreaking. Like, what does that mean in terms of this movie's, you know, mass appeal? If it's not a Moonlight phenomenon, and a phenomenon makes $28 million.
Why should a gay?
Yeah, well, I think that
to be groundbreaking.
Right, I completely agree with you. No, David, but that's how that seems to be how it's functioning.
I mean, I don't think we're talking about excitement because everybody liked this, and then I'm saying maybe I was overhyped for it and I didn't find it that groundbreaking. If we're talking about people going to see it, I really wanted to go see this movie because you guys kept talking about it. It just took forever to get here. It's completely an access issue. Like, if I could have seen this in November, maybe we could have had this conversation in November and I could have, you know, we could have been discussing if flies and apricots were both like equal themes and maybe like get a little bit further into it. But at this point, I feel like everybody talked about it already. And if I want to know everybody's opinion, I'll go read the posts and figure out who I agree or disagree with by not talking about it.
People
like,
have been
I
talking
found it.
About Call Me By Your Name for so long that Sufjan Stevens had time to write a song about I, Tanya. Well, that's not
we
a good
song.
We
don't know how long it took. We don't know how long it took, Sufjan. That's actually a pretty good song.
It's really good. Song.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know. I think that the rollout was maybe too long and too slow. Maybe they started too early. I don't really know the ins and outs. You probably have to look at the numbers of how it performed at every individual market. I'm sure that there was some strategy behind what they were doing, of course, but it did not pan out.
Do you think that the tone of the movie, too, the tone of the movie is not monumental? It's almost like what I love about the movie is what Dave's saying and how it's not kind of groundbreaking. It's very laid back. It's very sensual and, you know, the environment. You're not going to make a snazzy trailer out of it. There's not a lot of drama in the movie.
Oh, man.
This is a tough sell.
Seen the TV ads that they've been airing for it where, like, there's just this one disembodied moment of Armie Hammer's voice going, "Are you saying what I think you're saying?" And it's trying to make drama out of it, and it's awful.
Wow. Yeah, this is definitely a James Ivory movie. And this is not that's not something you could really sell to the masses.
I would imagine that if I didn't work in film, didn't know what this was, and in the dead of winter I saw a commercial for pretty people running around beautiful Crema, Italy, I would probably want to go spend 2 hours with them.
But I feel like it also, like, the whole Merchant Ivory, like, small scale roll up makes it feel boring in a way that this movie is not. Like, it's, there's so much fun to be had in it, but I feel like they're rolling it out as if it's kind of like an eat your vegetables art house movie.
Well, I think when we talked about it in the podcast earlier, Patches was saying how he's sort of sad that, like, teenagers can't see this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of agree with, like, that aspect of it. Like, the audience for it could be wider than gay romance, but it seems uninterested in finding any audience outside of just, like, existing.
Maybe there's not a great overlap between the older audience who actually goes to the movies you can rely on to feed into your grosses, and people who want to go see a movie like this. I mean, maybe I'm grasping at straws here, just looking at the numbers, but, like, maybe that generation is not going to want to be not going to be as comfortable with or as excited to see a gay romance as our generation would be.
Right.
But
well, I'll say this: if anybody is listening who's marketing a movie like Call Me By Your Name in the future, if it would have been on VOD the same week that the Armie Hammer dancing gif hit Twitter,
oh,
I would have bought it just, like, straight out.
Yeah. So, I don't know if I feel like VOD.
Yeah, I don't think this is a VOD movie. I don't really. I mean, and this movie will make plenty of money on ancillary markets. I'm sure that it will turn a profit for everybody involved.
Well, I looked it up. Luca Guadagnino's last movie, A Bigger Splash, made $2 million total.
Which is insane, because that's, like, such a fun movie. I don't know what people are doing.
Yeah. Well, this is going to do fine also, because it's, like, financed by, like, 15 different small entities.
No, yeah, it's probably already made its money back.
It's going to be great.
The Italian government paid for, like, half of it. I mean, everybody is making money here. They're going to be fine, but they should be making a lot more. Especially when you watch the trailer for Mamma Mia 2 and you're like, this movie is just a printing press and it's going to be terrible. Also, how did the Rent movie only make $29 million? Can you imagine if you made a Hamilton movie and it only made $29 million?
Well, if you made a Hamilton movie in like 15 years, this list that you're on, the LGBT Box Office Mojo list, David, is fascinating. The Danish Girl topped out at $11 million. So Call Me By Your Name has already outgrossed the Danish Girl. So we can be proud of that.
Good for Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah. I was thinking about the Danish Girl the other day. Best picture nominee, right?
But also, like, was the Danish Girl? I don't think it was. Once.
I like that Bruno is on this list. That's, yeah. I guess.
Yeah.
Call Me By Your Name will catch Carol very soon.
Carol is an interesting comparison. I mean, Carol obviously got kind of like fucked up by Harvey Weinstein, who's a completely different character in this, but it does feel like a similar kind of situation where it's like, critics love this movie, why can't we get anyone to go see it?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. There are definitely blind spots that I have living in this bubble where, you know, I would have told you, I don't know how much money, but I would have told you that Call Me By Your Name would make two or three times what it's made already. No problem. I would probably be faring better in the Oscar race than it is right now. Because there's only so much I can see out of my own head, and I think it's a shame that the movie isn't doing better. But
people might be listening to this and it might be coming to their town this weekend. Like, yeah. You know,
they, we're doing our part.
I mean, if it's playing in Durham, North Carolina, it's definitely coming to beyond just the biggest major markets at this point.
Yeah,
I want to hear the fly theories.
I want to know.
Is it one fly?
I want to know
one immortal fly.
You know, that we had somebody, I think, tweeted us that there were three AMCs in their town, and there was like one really crappy one, and that was obviously the one playing Call Me By Your Name. The other two were all full of whatever the fuck. And you know, I think a lot of it is maybe theaters not choosing to. I don't know what's happening. I think that this movie should be performing better, but and especially in a season where so many movies have done so well and exceeded expectations, some of them ludicrously, in the case of Jumanji, which is about as different a movie
or The Greatest Showman,
which is
so what you're saying is The like Rock should have played Army Hammer's part.
Why not? We've certainly done, I think every critic in America has sort of done their part to encourage people to see Call Me By Your Name.
The Shape of Water has made $37 million.
Yeah. Shape of Water is what constitutes a hit now in the Oscar game.
The Shape of Water and Three Billboards have made almost identical grosses at this point.
And they're both bad. So it's...
Hot take! And Dirk Sauer outgrossed them both.
Darkest Hour.
That is wild. Darkest Hour has made $45 million because and Call Me By Your Name has made 11. That movies? Is crazy.
Who goes to the movies? People who want to watch the fucking Darkest Hour. Also, True Stories seem to be performing very well on the regular just because people want to see what they already know. I wouldn't be surprised. Actually, I'm really curious how this new Clint Eastwood shit goes down because he can be hard to predict. I still don't think that anybody could have imagined that American Sniper would have made more than $300 million.
Highest grossing movie of 2013.
Yeah, and it was during the calendar year, but Guardians of the Galaxy eventually outgrossed it and also came out in 2013.
2014.
2014, yeah. 2014.
Yeah. It beat Guardians of the Galaxy. Maybe not worldwide. Anyway, this is anyway, sidebar.
Sidebar, yes. But yeah, I think I'm curious how that movie's gonna do because it's another sort of rah-rah anti-terrorism sort of thing, even maybe more so than American Sniper, which was kind of conflicted. It doesn't have a fake baby, as far as I know. That could hurt.
No promises.
No promises. I haven't seen it yet. No, I don't know anyone who's seen it yet. Why? I don't know. Call Me By Your Name. Dave loved it. We loved it.
We loved it.
Yeah, it's a really pleasant movie.
I
gotta read the book.
Wait, one really quick addendum to that is, I think a movie that is gonna could potentially be something of a groundbreaker. Is this movie coming out in March, I believe, or April, called Love, Simon, which is the first...
Yeah, that movie's going to be big.
Yeah, I think that movie could potentially be big. I would hope...
I'm curious.
Because I mean, it is a movie about Nick Robinson, a handsome all-American high school boy who is trying to come out in high school. And it is in the shape and form and tonality of a mainstream high school film. And, you know, high school movies have sort of, with your Edge of 17s and whatnot, have become more the indie territory recently. But this movie has a lot more commercial oomph than a 2 hour and change James Ivory film.
It also really has a Jack Antonoff score.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wait. Songs by Jack Antonoff. Sorry.
I was about to say, a score feels like a big leap for Jack Antonoff.
I hear from from inside sources that it's good, or that it at least played well for them. So we'll see.
That does it for this week's Friday in the War Room. We will be back next week. Don't forget to tweet at us or get in touch with us one way or another to recommend Netflix movies that you want us to watch. Individual recommendations are better, so we will all handpick them for each other. In the meantime, tell people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor at Thrillist.com, and we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them with your loved ones, or you can comment and leave our quarter quill answers there. We'll check that too to see if that's easier than Facebook or Twitter or something. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich, senior from Great Friendly Wire. You can find me on Twitter, David Ehrlich. You can find all of us on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room. And I just breaking news. I have some sad news to report. Scott Movie Mance has been parted ways with Access Hollywood after 17 years.
Wow!
Nice. See this news.
he will be skipping the next Access Hollywood. Sorry, he announced this in a post on Facebook. It looks there's a photo with him, Paul McCartney, and Billy Bush.
Wow.
Scott Movie Mance.
So the end of an era.
He's a good guy.
Yarmir Yager left the NHL for good. Scott Movie Mance is no longer with Access Hollywood.
Is he gonna have to drop movie from his middle name, or do you think that
I'll have to
see. The government's gonna come take it out, take it away from him?
So a lot's happening in the world. That's something.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. I also tweet about things and my work there, including my podcast, Storm of Spoilers, where this week I think we're doing like a crazy wheel of topics. Anyway, it's another pop culture chat show. And if you are the Dave fangirl from earlier in the episode, definitely check that one out.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com, where we're still working on the Still Watching Versace TV podcast series that Dave is editing. Joanna Robinson and Richard Lawson are hosting it. I am listening in from time to time. You should still listen to it. And also Little Old Men, which I try not to promote too much, but why not? You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter, where we want to hear from you about our quarter quell, about what you think, Call Me By Your Name, or you can answer this week's Lightning Round question. Sorry, we're at FITWR. What's this week's Lightning Round question?
In honor of Winchester, what urban legend or ghost story deserves a new or first big screen adaptation?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.